Welcome everyone to our book talk today with Devin Manzullo Thomas. Let me go ahead and introduce him briefly before I give some announcements on behalf of the Conference on Faith and History. Dr. Devin Manzullo Thomas is Assistant Professor of American Religious History and Director of the E. Morris and Leon Sider Institute for Anabaptist, Pietist, and Wesleyan Studies and Director of the Archives at Messiah University. The book that we are going to be discussing with him today is his publication with University of Massachusetts Press, Exhibiting Evangelicalism, Commemoration and Religion's Presence of the Past. So before I start getting into our conversation, let me go ahead and just share some news for you on behalf of the Conference on Faith and History. If you keep up with us on social media, which I highly recommend that you either follow us on Instagram or on X or Facebook or on Threads to keep up with information, particularly that has to do with our biennial conference that will be coming up in October. Our program chair, Chris Gertz, has been working vigilantly at developing this whole conference. It's going to take place for the undergraduate portion of it on October 9th through 10th at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. And then the professional conference will take place October 10th through 12th. Malcolm Foley, Karen Swallow Pryor, Benjamin Parks, Jonathan Bass, and of course, our CFH president will give a presidential address, Lisa Clark Diller. Those are the plenary speakers, but you still have an opportunity to submit a roundtable, panel, or paper for the conference. The current deadline is April 15th, and so if you can get on that and get that information into our program chair, I recommend that. You can go to faithandhistory.org and click on the conference tab to get more details about how to submit a paper or a presentation for the conference. We do monthly events for the Conference on Faith and History. They're virtual events. They always become part of our podcast. And so our next book talk is going to be on Thursday, May 9th at 12 p.m. Central Time. And it will be with Leah Payne about her recent Oxford University Press book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You. So I invite you to come back and listen for another book talk coming up. All right, Devin, let's go ahead and just get into this. Let me go ahead and just ask you with this first softball question. Tell me a little bit about how this research project started for you, and what is your book's overall argument, along with any other valuable contributions of the book?
Oh, thanks for that question, Joey. And I would just say thanks in general for putting this together. I'm super excited to be here and talking about this project. I'm grateful to all of you that are here and those of you that will listen to this as a podcast later on. So thanks for all of that. To answer your question, this project has been a long time in the making. I did my master's degree in public history at Temple University, started that in 2010. And I still remember in one of the first seminars that we had in that program that I was doing at the time, we read the book, The Presence of the Past by the late Roy Rosenzweig and David Thalen, foundational scholars in the scholarship of public history, you know, people who study how history is produced in public settings. It was a landmark study where these two authors surveyed thousands of Americans to find out how they think about the past, how they consume the past, how they value the past. Like, what is the presence of the past among Americans, right? And one of the things that they're really careful to do in that book and in the survey that was kind of the data collection tool for it is to ask about how identity shapes those patterns. So how do African Americans think about the past? How do, you know, women think about the past? How do, you know, a whole host of identities and the way that those identities shape the relationship that Americans have toward the past or toward history? One of the things that the authors don't do and are very upfront about not doing is asking about religion. They didn't ask about religion at all in their survey, which, you know, is shocking to me, right? Given the attention that they're paying to questions of identity, not asking about the way that one's personal faith or faith community is shaping their understanding of the past. But one of the interesting things is people brought it up anyway. So even though they weren't asked about it, Rosenzweig and Phelan had to admit that lots of their survey respondents talked about how faith influences their patterns of historical consumption or historical valuation. So I remember reading this book in 2010. I'm a first year MA student. And as someone who grew up in a religious community and was aware of the way, you know, was sensitive to the ways that that religious community taught me to think about the past and the value of the past, I was really mad. I was like really frustrated by this book and by the choices that these authors made in their study. And so I remember writing a seminar paper after we read the book that was probably, I mean, I haven't looked at it in a long time now, but it was probably a screed, right? Like one of those things that you do when you're an early master's student that like you're kind of embarrassed about, you know, a decade later. But even though it probably was a screed, my instructor at the time, who later became my dissertation advisor and chair, Seth Brueggemann, I remember that at the end of that term paper, he wrote something like, turn this into your dissertation or study this more, right? Like fill this gap in the literature. And that was the moment really where the genesis for this project began. So it was a long time in the making, but it had its roots in that MA seminar over a decade ago. And it's now a book, which is very cool. So in terms of the arguments, in terms of the case I'm trying to make in this book, you know, put very simply, I'm trying to make the case that evangelicals are and have been for a long time public historians. They have developed convictions about and practices for preserving and interpreting their past in public spaces. In the book, I term those convictions and practices, I term that evangelical heritage. And I use the term heritage very deliberately, sort of in contrast to history, but also in a way where I can sort of study what it is that they're trying to do with these historical products that they're producing. And I argue that they use evangelical heritage toward varying theological, cultural, and political ends. Those ends change across the period that I study. The book covers about, you know, the kind of World War II, post-World War II era, right up to the present. And I argue that the ends toward which evangelical heritage was mobilized have changed over time, despite some consistencies across time as well. Another kind of key argument that I'm trying to make in the book is that evangelicals have a distinctive way of conceptualizing history. That's baked into evangelical heritage, right? A distinct way of thinking about what history is, what it does, what its sources are. You know, what are the sources of knowledge for doing history? Those are particular for evangelicals. And then ultimately, why history matters, why it's useful, what it's for, right? And that argument is me trying to be consistent with some of the scholarship in the field of religion and memory more generally. There are really great books that have come out in the last 10, 15, 20 years about the ways that different religious communities conceptualize the past. And so I'm trying to add my voice to that conversation. And I think the third thing that I'm trying to argue in the book, and maybe this is the one that will be most relevant to folks in the CFH. I'm trying to argue that historical narratives, that history as a product has a shaping influence on evangelical identity. And I, you know, I'm part of a growing trend historiographically that want to push back against defining evangelicalism solely in terms of the Bevington quadrilateral. I think theology is important in defining evangelical identity, but I think in the year of our Lord 2024, we can't buy into the argument anymore that it's only theology that defines evangelical identity. I think we know better than that. And so I'm trying to make the case that these historical narratives that these museums produce are part of what shape the contours of evangelical belonging.
Yeah, I mean, your argument of the history of evangelicalism and how it's presented publicly and how it's narrated, if the emphases are not theological, but they are, you know, related to public figures and their legacies and their stories and their relationships and the politics. It's compelling to say, well, you know, there's cultural and social concerns that also drive identity for evangelicals. And you
That's
do
right.
a good job of demonstrating how that imaginary evolves and develops throughout the narrative. Okay, so getting to one of these tropes that you look at, women played a large role in memorializing the evangelical heritage. So would you discuss their role, challenges they encountered, and what you think is the significance of their role, as well as the significance of, even at times you mentioned, like, intended exclusion in memorializing the evangelical heritage?
Yeah. So let me set a context, and then I want to say two things. So the context is, you know, part of the reason that I was compelled to focus on the role of women in these projects is because that's what the archive revealed to me. But it's also the case that scholarship on, you know, the history of museums, on public history generally, has really engaged questions of gender in the construction of American public memory. You know, so there are lots of great books that talk about the reality that a lot of the kind of biggest institutions on the American memorial commemorative landscape were established by women, but quickly taken over by men, men in power who then excluded those women from the narrative of the history of those museums. So, like, Jefferson's Monticello, a number of places that, like, you know, we visited with our families, right? Or like we went on middle school and high school field trips to, right? So there's a longer history of women contributing to American public memory and then being excluded from the memory of the making of that public memory. So I think it's important to set what my book is trying to do in that larger context. I think there are two directions in which I can answer this question. One is to talk about specifically the women who were involved in creating these museums. The other way to talk about it is the way that women in the historical narrative are present or not present in the museums themselves, right? So the way that women who did play a role in the history of evangelicalism are actually then excluded or minimized in the exhibits. So I'll start with the first one. One of the most interesting things to me as I did the research for this book was discovering the role of women in the creation of many of these museums, house museums, major museums, even churches that have a kind of commemorative function. And it was true almost across every institution that I looked at that a woman or women played some role in helping to create these spaces, even when they were largely ignored in the memory of those places afterward. The person that I most love to talk about, again, there are lots of women that I could talk about. The person that I most love to talk about is this woman called Lois Firm. She was educated at Houghton College and married a man, Bob Firm, who went on to work for the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association almost from its genesis in the late 1940s. His name is everywhere. You know, he co-authored books with Billy Graham. He did groundwork for many of the Crusades. He edited the magazine, I think, of the BGEA for a while. Her name is less everywhere, although it should be in more places, right? And one of those places that it should be is in the history of the Billy Graham Center Museum, which is on the campus of Wheaton College. When the BGEA board started putting pressure on Billy Graham in the late 60s, early 70s to think about, okay, we've got all these records now of, you know, two decades of Crusades, what are we going to do with them? When Graham started to feel that pressure, he turned to Lois Firm. Firm by that point was an accomplished librarian. She was in the middle of a doctoral program at the University of Minnesota for library science and archives management. And Graham knew her because of her connection to, you know, his employee, Bob Firm. And so he brings Lois Firm into the process of putting this museum together, figuring out, like, what do we do with these records? And Lois Firm is actually the person who comes up with the idea for what is now the Billy Graham Center Museum. You know, she from the, you know, from 1970 onward, she's saying, you know, Billy, you need a presidential library. You need a place that is going to promote your memory. And she meant that in a positive way, right? Like kind of, we might say spin your memory, right? Like promote you as a serious figure who needs to be taken seriously, who is just as important as a, you know, a US president. She talks about the need for experiencing the past in this place and not just, you know, she's got this great line that I quote all the time in the book about like, we don't want this museum to just be a bunch of dusty artifacts sitting around in glass cases, right? We want people to have an experience when they come here. And she meant that in two ways. She meant like an experience of the past. So how can we immerse people in the past? She also meant a conversion experience. She wanted the museum to, you know, one of the functions for her of evangelical heritage was to convert people to the faith. She, in her like zeal to put this together, does a bunch of things that really make the board members of the BGEA, who were all men, really makes them mad. And, you know, in her version of the narrative, they sideline her completely from the project. And I've got these great letters, that I don't know that anyone can access now because they're in the archive down in Charlotte now. But these great letters where she says to Billy Graham, like, I know that I made people mad and I'm really sorry. And so I'll just walk away from this project because I don't want to mess it up. And Graham ends up keeping her on as his personal librarian, and she works for him for many, many years. She pulls together this amazing oral history project, but she basically disappears from the record of the museum and its creation, but her ideas don't. So like almost everything that she says in the early 1970s and some of these planning documents and these proposals, almost all of it ends up in the museum that is built in Wheaton by men, right? One of the things that was super interesting about writing about Lois Firm in this book is that when I would ask the men who ran the museum for many years, some of whom are still connected to the museum, when I would ask them about Lois Firm to a person, they would say, "I'm not sure why you're asking about her. She didn't have a role here, right?" We know that's not true, right? I mean, like I have the receipts, as my students would say. So she was just this amazing figure in the story, and I think speaks for the whole, right? And the way that women often get kind of marginalized in the narratives of these institutions. I also think it's important, like I said, to point out that like women from the history of evangelicalism are also often excluded from the exhibits. One example of this is that in the earliest version of the museum at Wheaton, there's this back and forth that I found in the archives between the archivist, I think it's the archivist and the curator, and then kind of the administrative staff about whether Amy Semple McPherson should get mentioned in the narrative, like in the exhibit hall. And they end up not including her, and it's because she's too controversial. I don't know what they meant by that. They didn't go into detail, but she's excluded from the narrative. I think she's in there now. Like if you go today, there's been some revisions to it, and I think she's in there now. But she apparently wasn't in the first version.
I don't mean to interrupt, but
no, you're
I am
fine.
In Edith Blumhofer's previous office, and
there you go. Right,
one of the items that was left in the office is a legitimate revival poster that's behind me of Amy Semple McPherson. Was that part of what might have gone in? I don't know.
It's a great question. Yeah. So I guess in terms of gender, in terms of women's roles specifically, I would say those two directions are really crucial in sort of understanding what's going on in these institutions. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. And maybe just to comment and build on it a little bit, Park Street, there was a group of women that were involved in as volunteerists. In fact, I'm wondering how much invisible labor women have done in the evangelical heritage of free labor, volunteer labor. That has been there because these Park Street women organized the tours and were the docents on the tours. Yep. For Park Street. Yep. And so that's another instance.
Yeah. Until they got really popular when a male pastor that was on the staff was put in charge of kind of directing I forget the name of the Freedom Trail in Boston.
Oh,
Once the
yeah,
Freedom Trail became really
yes.
big, right? And like
Yep.
thousands of tourists were going into and out of Park Street Church every summer. Then the pastoral staff kind of picked up on it, and eventually by the 70s, like there's a member of the staff who has some kind of oversight role. But like for the first decade, yeah, it was these volunteer, they were called hostesses. I mean, it was
Yeah.
even in gendered language around their the role that they weren't docents, right? They were hostesses. So yeah, invisible labor. And actually, it took me a long time to track down that information, even because there weren't a lot of records that were maintained in the Park Street collection about their role. So I have these like tantalizingly small glimpses of what it was like for these hostesses to lead these tours, and then they sort of. I'm sure that there continue to be women even to this day who, on a voluntary basis, give tours and things like that at Park Street, but they sort of get minimized in the narrative. Yeah.
And of course, Helen Sunday for Billy
Yeah.
Sunday's
Yep.
poem. So, and
Yeah.
we'll get to talk more about that in a
Yeah.
minute. So you covered a few different venues of memorializing the evangelical heritage. So we have a museum house, Billy Sunday's home. We have a church, Park Street Church, a center at a college, the Billy Graham Center and Library, and then the hometown library. The latter two even had distinct ethos. In many ways, the latter one synthesized. And as I looked at some of your documentation, it appears like at least one whole exhibit is the same exhibit. The Main Street exhibit is here at Billy's Center, but it looks like it was duplicated down in Charlotte as well. So what value did these distinct venues offer in the storyline of developing an evangelical heritage? How did their modes reflect ways of public remembrance during the eras they were developed?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I said that this book began as my doctoral dissertation, and my advisor, Seth Brueggemann, one of the things I love about him is that he's like deeply committed to interdisciplinary scholarship. It's one of the things that drew me to my doctoral program at Temple. And he would often say to me, drawing on like communication studies and performance studies, that classic line, like the medium is the message. And
Yeah,
that's so
you're
true for
close.
these evangelical museums, right? Like what they're trying, they're the purposes to which they are putting evangelical heritage are directly tied to the types of places that they are, right? I make these cases kind of sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly in the book, but I'll just say like it's really important that Park Street Church didn't build a separate center where they took their history tours. Like it was really important for Harold Ockingay and other ministers at the church that like the people who are on these tours go into the church. They see that it's a working church. Part of their agenda for mobilizing this history was like, people need to see that evangelicals are like proud, contributors to this nation's history, like ongoing contributors. This isn't just a relic of the past. We've been here for a long time and we continue to be here, right? The Billy Graham Center at Wheaton, like it was really important to the BGEA eventually. It was really important to the BGEA that this center be at an academic institution. This was a period of time, right, mid to late 1970s, when evangelicalism in America was gaining prominence, but also, controversial, right? I mean, this is in
Yeah.
the wake of Watergate. This is in the wake of some other things that are going on for evangelicals in the 70s. And so the respectability, right? Like we aren't, we're not the hucksters of Elmer Gantry. We're not something new on the block, right? Like we are respectable. We are here. We're a part of the nation, right? So that gravitas. The Billy Graham Library is in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is Graham's hometown. It has a version of his childhood home that has been trans. I mean, it's the they take a lot of pride, and it's like it's the floorboards that he walked on and the bricks that he would have touched when he was a child, right? But they've moved it from its original location to the campus, and then the library itself is built as a barn, right? And so it's meant to evoke this kind of pastoral, you know, like Jeffersonian, rugged individualist, Southern agrarian kind of thing that, you know, my argument is it's meant to evoke nostalgia, right? It's meant to evoke nostalgia for a particular vision of American life, a particular time of American life. And so those, the spaces and the construction of the spaces and the way that history is presented in the spaces, the medium really is the message, right?
We could even talk about your conclusion, the Museum of the Bible. I mean, originally going to be in Dallas because it's part of the Bible Belt, but you know what? But let's put it by the capital.
Strategically, that's right. Strategically in the nation's capital, you know, a stone's throw from the mall where, you know, the largest and most visited museums in the American commemorative landscape are located. That was not accidental, right? Like that was very intentional. And it was also very intentional to have this kind of state-of-the-art, cutting-edge, technologically advanced museum, right? This is not, this isn't fly-by-night. This isn't like, this is important stuff, right? And we're going to create a museum that demonstrates how important it is and how cutting-edge it is to engage with, that's how they talk about it, engage with the Bible, right? Engage with the influence of the Bible in America's past. So yeah, very intentional. You know, the medium is the message, but the way that history is deployed in these spaces is also really interesting, right? You talked about the modes of commemoration that are used. One of the things that was most interesting to me in writing this book and trying to be very intentional about tying it to the history of museums, the history of public history as a profession, right, and how it's developed over time. What I discovered was that a lot of the things that these purveyors of evangelical heritage are doing are also part of the professional discourse of public historians, but often evangelicals are kind of on the cutting edge of some of these public history practices. So I'll give two examples here, right? So you mentioned Helen Sunday, Billy Sunday's widow, who when he passes away, turns their home in Winona Lake, Indiana, into, at least in the summers, a house museum where she's welcoming visitors to the Winona Lake Bible Conference. She's welcoming them into their her home, giving tours of her home. Right before she passes away, I think she passes away in like 55, 56. I'm forgetting the exact date, but right before she passes away, this enterprising couple from the Bible Conference, they record her giving the tour. So really the only reason that we know anything now about what her tour sounded like and how she talked about her husband, how she talked about the home is because of this recording from, again, I think 1954. Audio tours, they're super commonplace now, right? But in the history of public history, they don't really emerge until like the late 1950s, early 1960s. But when Helen Sunday passes away, the people who operate the house museum afterwards use this recording to move people through the home, right? So very cutting edge, what is now common public history practice, right? But very cutting edge when a member of my dissertation committee read this in one of the earliest drafts, she was like, you know that people weren't doing this in the 1950s, right? I was like, I did not know that. And she gave me all of this scholarship on how it doesn't develop really until the late 50s, early 60s. So that was a really cool discovery. The other one that I would point back to, I referenced earlier, this kind of experiential approach to history, right? And, you know, again, I think we'd, you know, those of us that go to museums all the time know that this is very commonplace now as a practice in museums, immersion in the past. It's not just display cases, it's dioramas and things like that. That really emerges in, the literature says that it emerges around the time of the bicentennial, so like mid to late 1970s. I actually think it's a little bit earlier than that. I think we have some examples of institutions that are kind of forgotten that do this earlier. But the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton, right, is on the cut. If we take it to be, you know, mid to late 1970s, Billy Graham Center at Wheaton opens in 1980. That's the cutting edge of an experiential approach to doing public history. And the early I think you can sense this if you go to the Billy Graham Center today, but the earliest version of the museum very much is embracing this immersive, experiential, affective approach to engaging with history. And I describe some of those exhibits in the book. I won't take time here to do that, but I describe some of them in the book. And they're very much part of this kind of cutting edge mode of engaging people in the past beyond just like artifacts and text panel labels.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just quickly mention, like, there was the one where you could ask Billy Graham a question, essentially, and he would respond with a recording. Yeah. There's another one where you can record your own kind of conversion story experience.
Yeah.
And so,
And the space itself is meant to look like the studio in which Graham would have recorded Hour of Decision, his like very popular radio broadcast. So you're like, you're not just recording it. You're not just asking Billy Graham a question. You're like doing it in this space that is meant to replicate a space that he would have sat in. Another just very quick example of this, this is in the current museum. It wasn't in the original one. I think when it was renovated in the 90s, this was added. But there's a part of the museum now where you can go and you're actually invited to stand in the pulpit that Graham preached from. It was like created by the IBM Corporation. It was like moved around to a lot of his crusades in like the 70s and 80s. But you're invited to stand there under the glass. There's like handwritten notes of his sermons, right? And if you look up the space in which this pulpit is located, the walls reproduce like a photo of a crusade audience crowd. So like literally you're putting yourself in the shoes of Billy Graham. You are immersed, right, in what it would, and like the text panels ask you to like think about what it would feel like if you were, you know, giving this sermon to this crowd and talking to people like Billy Graham did. So very immersive, very affective way of engaging with the past.
And maybe even to build up on some of your ideas and your material in the book, these environments are created to be efficacious, and one of the goals is conversion.
Yeah, that's right.
But and I don't think you really say this like clearly, but in the history of Protestant Christianity in the U.S., in material history and in visiting landmarks, there is a calling kind of move that takes place where people will go to places where Protestant missionaries and their relics are there, their grave sites, and they'll experience like the calling to go to be a missionary. Yes. Yes. And being at Wheaton College with a lot of students that are exploring vocation and calling, there is this sense in which it invites people to become revivalists, to become missionaries, to be so.
Yeah. Well, and I should say too, Joe, you made me think of this when you were commenting. I think for evangelical public historians, right, like the people who are creating these spaces, the impetus for this experiential history, it is actually at least partly different than the impetus for secular public historians, right? Yeah. Like I root it in very much the kind of heart religion of American evangelicalism, right? That very affective, emotive, like, you know, John Wesley talked about his heart being strangely warmed, right? And it's that kind of revivalistic faith that I think mobilizes people like Lois Firm to say, no, they should have an experience, right? When they go into this museum, they should be affectively changed, not just because that's good pedagogical practice for a history museum, but because it's religiously significant, right?
Oh, yeah,
and
it's the voluntarist.
So I do think that's
tradition.
A really important part of their motivation there. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So respectability and worthiness to be remembered seem to be an ongoing trope in each phase of developing the evangelical heritage and attachment or connection to people of political influence. We see this both with memorializing Billy Sunday and with also Billy Graham. So that, and also like the influence of celebrity and the wide cultural appeal, it was crucial for these individuals. What would you say this observation may mean for the wider evangelical culture and its aspirations? Are there ways we are seeing this quest for celebrity or proximity to celebrity as being detrimental to the ongoing story of the evangelical heritage? And maybe just to like say the connection to Richard Nixon, it turned upside down on Billy Graham.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is such a great question and really rich. And I think there are a lot of different directions I could go in answering it. So I'll try and limit myself. I mentioned respectability already as one of the reasons why the BGA board eventually locates the Billy Graham Center and its museum at Wheaton College, right? They wanted that kind of gravitas that came from an academic institution. And that was largely, as you have gestured at, a strategic move for the organization in the wake of, Billy Graham had been very, very proximal to Richard Nixon in the late 60s and early 1970s leading up to Watergate. He stuck by him, for a long time during and after the Watergate scandal. And it's only in the wake of all of that that he kind of confesses his complicity in electoral politics and apologizes and, I think in contrast to some evangelical leaders today, really does try and distance himself in some ways from kind of overt politicking. But it's in the wake of that the BGA board decides to put it at Wheaton College. And so I do think that in some sense, they saw respectability distancing them from some of the more negative associations with kind of celebrity culture or proximity to cultural and political power, which is really interesting because not all the other museums that I study do that, right? In some ways, proximity to cultural and political power or celebrity is one of the messages that these institutions are trying to send, right? So I'll just talk about the Billy Sunday home. There's this amazing photo that I found in the archive of Helen Sunday sitting in the final room of the tour, which was their bedroom, her and Billy's bedroom. And on the wall of the bedroom are all these signed photographs of kind of significant Americans from the first, I don't know, quarter, 30, 40 years of the 20th century. So politicians, movie stars, Cecil B. DeMille is one of them, famous sports figures, famous industrialists, right? And on the tour, Helen talks about the significance of all of these. Oh, Billy and I were friends with all of these people. These people supported his evangelistic campaigns. These are really important people. And then in the photo in the archives, she is sitting on she's sitting on a bench at the bottom of these photos, right? And, in the tour, she talks about how this bench is the bench that she and Billy courted on, right? And so she's in this photo on this bench. The photos are all on the wall behind her, right? And it's this amazing tableau that really speaks to what she's trying to do on the tour, right? You've got her, you've got these celebrity photos, and you've got this space on the bench that is meant to be occupied by Billy Sunday, right? And so for her, it's this moment in the tour where it's like, we were at the center of American public life. Evangelicals were at the center of American public life. She has some comments later on in the recording where she's like, and now we're getting back to it, right? We've got people like Billy Graham and Youth for Christ leaders who are putting us back in the center of American public life and bringing up evangelism, up, 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 she says, in the way that it used to be. So it's very much for her that celebrity and proximity to cultural power and political power is not something to distance yourself from. It's actually really important to her version of evangelical heritage. Evangelicals are not marginal. Evangelicals are not these kind of cultural weirdos. They are at the center of American public life. I think you see something very similar going on at the Billy Graham Library in Charlotte, North Carolina. The argument there is very much that, there's a whole gallery, which I think is so weird. There's a whole gallery in that museum of it's meant to look like the cross point at the Berlin Wall. In the 1980s, right? I mean, you're in this room. It's got there's a literal wall that's in this room. There's a Checkpoint Charlie soldier station there. There's a spotlight that is spinning around the room the whole time that you're in it, and they play this movie on the wall. It functionally, I mean, to oversimplify, makes the case that Billy Graham helped to end the Cold War, Right. So, you know, so that kind of proximity to cultural and political power is very important for the message that that museum is trying to make. They're not trying to distance themselves from it. Billy Graham is at the heart of global public life. Right. And, you know, we already mentioned the Museum of the Bible, again, a strategic choice to put it in Washington, D.C., you know, that implicitly, if not explicitly, says, you know, the Bible, the history of the Bible is as important to American public life as, you know, what's going on at the Air and Space Museum a stone's throw from here, or at, you know, the National Museum of African American History and Culture that's a stone's throw from here, right? They're trying to locate themselves at the center of that political and cultural power. So, it's interesting to think about. I mean, one other dimension of this, right, is who is remembered at these spaces, right? Yeah. Like, two museums to Billy Graham, right? A museum to Billy Sunday. One of the places that I don't get to talk about in the book, but that I'm really interested in writing and thinking about a little bit more is Amy Semple McPherson has a house museum that's dedicated to her in Los Angeles, right next door to Angelus Temple, where, you know, that she founded and created. And I got to go last summer and visit. So I'm also thinking about this question, Joey, in terms of like the celebrity of the commemorated individual and the way that, you know, the selective remembering of the past filters out these figures who are kind of quote unquote celebrities who stand for the whole, right? And you know, there are, you know, there's no Ronald J. Sider house museum, right? And there's no, like, I'm just thinking about like figures from evangelical history who are not remembered, right? And so I think the strategic remembering here is also bound up in that question of celebrity.
Yeah. I just thought about the fact that when I've done a New Haven tour, we go to East Windsor and we see the home that Jonathan Edwards was raised in.
Yeah.
But we can't go on the lawn because somebody owns that home and lives in that home, and that's their house.
Yes. And there's a long history of birthplace museums as being really important to, you know, if we think about the history of museums as these places that are meant to like inculcate civic virtue, right? Going back to the natal home of a great American is meant to sort of fortify visitors that they can be that great too, right? Yeah. If they just like take these lessons from the past from great Americans. So you know, the strategic use of Graham's childhood home at the Billy Graham Library, but also, right, like an Edwards birthplace memorial, right? There are political dimensions to those kind of efforts to remember seminal individuals.
Before I ask this last question, if you have a question for Devin, please go ahead and drop that in the chat so we do have some time to look at those. My last question for you is, and this kind of is a little bit along the lines of what we've been talking about, but are there other venues that are noteworthy in the story of evangelical heritage? Are they being researched? What do you think about the close of the American Bible Society Museum in Philadelphia? What other scholarship are you working on? So that's
I love all these questions. So very quickly, I mentioned the Amy Semple McPherson house museum. I got to visit that last summer. Super interesting, very different from the places that I describe in the book. I give a shout out here to Matt Sutton who put me onto that house museum at a American Society for Church History meeting a couple years ago. Is presenting some of this research, and he's like, have you gone to Amy Semple McPherson's house museum yet? I hadn't. I have now. It's fascinating. There's a Jerry Falwell Museum at Liberty University. I have not been able to visit that yet. They are actually renovating it right now, so it's closed to the public. But I really hope to get there. Obviously, there are also versions of these kinds of museums that are run by denominations, right? So the best example of this is in Springfield, Missouri. That's the headquarters of the Assemblies of God Church. They have an amazing archive and museum there called the Flower Pentecostal Heritage Center. Highly recommend going there. It's fascinating to see the way that they kind of exhibit the history of the Pentecostal movement in the United States at that space. You mentioned the American Bible Society Museum in Philadelphia that just closed. It's called the Faith, or it was called the Faith and Liberty Discovery Center. I feel like I could write like a whole journal article just on that name alone and the significance of what they're trying to do in that name. I went right when they opened in 2021, and I actually canceled a day of class at the end of March so that I could go to the museum again before it closed very suddenly at the end of March. I would like to write something about it. I'm really interested. I mean, I was interested in it before they announced its very sudden closing. I am really interested in why it closed so suddenly. And I don't just mean like the inside baseball of the ABS, which I know that there's a lot going on there. It sounds like from some of their press releases, but I'm interested in thinking about, you know, it didn't win over a number of visitors, and like the Museum of the Bible, it is a stone's throw, like literally a stone's throw from Independence Hall, from the Liberty Bell Center. So they were not distanced from the thousands of tourists that come to Philadelphia every year. But why it didn't, you know, the Museum of the Bible welcomes a million plus visitors every year, at least according to some of the records that I was able to access. But this one didn't, right? There was a Christianity Today article that suggested that as low as 5,400 people came in one calendar year to that museum. So I'm really interested in why not, right? And what that tells us about the state of public culture in America, what it tells us about kind of the significance of evangelical heritage on a broader scale, like within the larger commemorative landscape. Like, I kind of end my book saying, like, the Museum of the Bible is the future of evangelical heritage. And the collapse of the Faith and Liberty Discovery Center actually makes me want to revisit that a little bit and see, you know, maybe what's going on there. So that might be something that I'm working on. The larger project that I'm interested in pursuing is originally the dissertation that I projected to my committee, pitched to my committee, was a project that went from about 1876 to the present, right? I wanted to start like at the American centennial and look at how Protestants commemorated their pasts in public up to the Museum of the Bible, right? And once I got into the archives at Wheaton for the Billy Graham Center Museum, I was like, oh no, I have a whole book just on 45 up. And so I kind of, I cut the like first, you know, half century from the project. And I'd like to go back, right? And I'd like to kind of tell the prequel to exhibiting evangelicalism. Evangelicals didn't invent the idea of being a religious community that presents their past in public spaces for kind of strategic, political, and cultural and theological reasons. And so the project that I'll work on next is that prehistory. Yeah. And I will probably end up setting it, I haven't really thought through this entirely yet, but I'll probably end up setting it in Philadelphia. There are a number of kind of institutions that were or still are in Philadelphia that I think could narrate the story that I feel like is emerging from the archive. So
wonderful.
Stay tuned for that one.
Okay. So Alicia Kaufman has a question. She says, I was first introduced to the idea of heritage tourism by a conference paper on Mormonism. Do you compare evangelical heritage history presentations to Mormon ones? Also, is there still a heaven room at the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton? Yes, there is, Alicia.
Yes, there is.
And how would you determine who's an evangelical before 1945? Thank you for that question.
These are great questions, Alicia. Thank you. So yes, the Heaven Room is still there. I actually got to go to Wheaton and give a talk about my book last fall. And my wife and my son came along with me, and I made them take a picture with me in the Heaven Room. I have colleagues here at, I teach at Messiah University. I have colleagues here who are Wheaton graduates. And when I told them that I was writing about the Billy Graham Center Museum, they laughed at me and said the only thing they remember from that museum is the Heaven Room. And also that it's the place that they would send their parents on parents weekend when they wanted to get rid of them for a couple of hours. And that their parents always loved the Heaven Room. So the Heaven Room is still there. The question about Mormonism is really great. Mormons have a very distinctive history when it comes to heritage and the kind of cultural and political functions of heritage. There's a great book chapter in an edited collection that was actually done by my dissertation chair, Seth Brueggemann. The book is about the history of birthplace museums in the United States, and there's a chapter in there about the strategic use of Joseph Smith's birthplace in the early 20th century as a way to sort of narrate the respectability of Mormonism, attach it to larger American narratives, downplay, forget, right? Strategically forget, to put it in the language of commemoration, the plural marriage, right? Specifically, right? Like downplay some of the more harder edges of Mormonism's history. So yes, a huge, I don't do anything in my book on comparing the two. That would be a really interesting project. I would love for someone to do that. I think there's probably a lot of a lot to be said there. The only connection is, I think that Mormons have a distinctive historical imaginary. Evangelicals have a distinctive historical imaginary. So I do a little bit of that, right? Just saying kind of like lots of different religious communities have different ways of thinking about history, its purposes, its sources. So I compare it a little bit in that regard. Your question about how I would determine who's an evangelical before 1945 is a really good one. And like, do you have a couple of hours for me to talk through that? One of the things I do in the book, right, is I try to be strategic about the way that I use the term evangelical.
Yeah, for you me, prefer conservative Protestant.
I do because, yep. So I try and make the distinction in the book between conservative Protestant, which is a problematic term and not without its liabilities, right? But I try to distinguish between conservative Protestant and evangelical so that I can emphasize that evangelical is a socially constructed identity. And not kind of like a stable category, right? Part of what I'm trying to say in the book is that evangelicalism and its boundaries are actually built and constructed through things like historical narratives. So people come to think of themselves at, my argument about, for instance, the Billy Sunday house is that Helen Sunday is using it to help people who come to the Winona Lake Bible Conference from lots of varied denominations and backgrounds and theological traditions. She's trying to use this space to help them think of themselves as a coherent thing called evangelical, right? So that's all preface for me to say, I try not to use the term unless I'm talking about how it's constituted, right? And like the identity that is taken on by people who adopt a socially constructed identity like that. So I actually don't know that I would, or at least in the research that I've done so far and the bit of writing that I've done so far on this next project, I don't think I'm going to use the term evangelical. Or if I do, I'll be really careful about kind of how I use it and how that links to kind of these questions of social construction of group membership. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll throw in.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I'll throw in my quick two cents about this one. So I'm working on writing a brand history of evangelicalism that really kind of starts similar to the period that exhibiting evangelicalism did. And much of what I tentatively plan to argue is that historians who called themselves evangelicals, or interested in evangelical history, maybe starting with Timothy Smith, Bebbington, Marsden, Knoll, in many ways, they decided who were the evangelicals and what the headwaters of evangelicalism was, and have in many ways defined that for us and created what I sometimes call the brand evangelical narrative or story for us. And so and that's related to like Reformed conservative Protestantism being centered as the respectable group who we should look to and see. And so like a Jonathan Edwards and a Timothy Dwight are the better kind of evangelicals than the Charles Finneys and so on and so forth. Yeah. So, or they get elevated in those histories and those stories that have been written.
Yeah.
So
evangelical before 45, like, not using that will be helpful in some ways, but you still have to determine who and where gets in or out and on what basis.
Yeah, and no, that's an inclusion-exclusion story in itself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I'm one of the things I'm interested in is thinking about how or how not the process of commemoration and strategic remembering in some of these communities maps onto, or again, doesn't map onto our discourses of how Protestant identity is being constantly recreated and refashioned, right? So, like, do these projects of commemoration that, say, Presbyterians are doing in the early 20th century in Philadelphia, how do they map onto the debates happening in the denomination about who's too conservative and who's too liberal, right? Like, I think I'm interested in thinking about how the work of commemoration produces those identities and draws those boundaries. It is a little bit of a catch-22, though, because I have to decide who I'm focusing on and who I'm not focusing on, who I'm including and who I'm excluding. But I'm trying to do that again at two levels, right? One is the level of like what's happening in the archive. The other is like how are these projects themselves creating or reifying the identity boundaries that are operating at that time and in those spaces. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, like I would wonder, like in the public history for any Pentecostal charismatic sort of remembrance, or how do they use the term evangelical?
Right.
And you know, Molly Worthen's Apostles of Reason like really helps us make think of, helps us think about like who did the neo-evangelicals exclude at the table, and then how did those people get at the table or get into the table, and when, and how did they perceive themselves? And
That's
so,
interesting.
what do you do with the lost cause now that we know that that is such a strong constituent stream of what is evangelicalism?
Yeah, that's a
Evangelicalism is a Southern strategy plus conservative Protestantism, and you can't
Yeah.
tell that without the Daughters of the Confederacy.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing point. I mean, strategically locating this next book in Philadelphia, gives me a little bit of distance from that, right? Doesn't mean that I won't have to engage it at all, but I'm not a Southern historian. That's not my background, that's not my training, that's not the area that I know particularly well. But you're pointing to one thing that I think is really salient, which is the kind of the politics of public memory and the way that the way that remembering is vitally connected to the political projects that are happening at the time. So, for instance, one of the like journal articles that I'm working on right now is a history of this statue of Francis Asbury in Washington, D.C. It's not necessarily about the lost cause, but the statue and its and like the text on the pedestal is very much locating this commemorative project within the larger discourse of empire that's happening at the time, right? The statue fashions Asbury as a founder of, and the language is our Christian civilization, which is a raced and classed discourse that intersects with questions of imperialism in, the early 20th century. So it is really important to think. One of the challenges in calling something evangelical heritage is that it's easy to distance it from larger kind of historical narratives, memory narratives that are being produced at this time. And so thinking about how some of these narratives intersect with lost cause mythology is really important. I do a little bit of this in my book in the Billy Graham Library chapter around questions of nostalgia. Like the nostalgia that's presented there is absolutely raced. It's absolutely white. The barn is, when you walk in, is filled with these kind of agrarian tools, right, of the early 20th century. These pictures of like, farm hands out in the fields or, with livestock and stuff. Everyone's white. Everyone in the photos is white. The only, I want to be careful about how I say this. So there's an animatronic cow that welcomes visitors in the at the start of the library. The voice of that animatronic cow is unmistakably the voice of a Black woman, and it is the only way in which a person of color enters into how the space is visually remembering, right? That is not separate from questions of the lost cause narrative, I don't think. right? I don't get into that explicitly in the book, but I think it's very part and parcel of that larger memory mythology.
Okay. So, Devin, thank you so much for sitting with us and for us to get to hear more about your book. I highly recommend, if you haven't purchased it, getting it and reading it. Thank you to all the people who joined us today for our book talk. Please come back for another. We'll be doing another book talk on May 9th with Leah Payne. God gave rock and roll to you. Alicia, I still need to have a conversation with you about your Turning Points book. And so we need to get that on the list as well. If you are interested in participating in the CFH Biennial Conference, which will take place at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, from October 9th through 12th, go ahead and visit our website, faithandhistory.org, and hit the tab for conferences. You'll be able to see the call for papers from Chris Gertz, our program chair. You can squeeze in a proposal for a roundtable panel paper. The soft deadline, or the deadline that's set right now, is April 15th, but I don't know if I've ever seen a society not extend their deadline for a conference paper. So it'll probably be extended. And so thanks again, Devin, and for everybody who participated today. And I want to wish you a great day. Thanks.